A reading from the Epistle to the Hebrews. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who was invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. The word of the Lord.
We're really just getting started here in the life of Moses. Last week we learned about his mother hiding him and him growing up in the courts of Pharaoh, but being exiled for protecting one of the Hebrews by killing an Egyptian. So now we're picking up Genesis chapter 3. And this can be a really confusing chapter because the sequence of events, in my opinion, is confused. The story as it was laid out in Genesis, at least as we have it, doesn't have the sequence correctly. Things happen in a different order. Yes?
Genesis chapter 3.
Exodus chapter 3. Yeah, no, my notes just say chapter 3. Forgot what book we were in. Exodus chapter 3. I'm so glad Cheryl pays such close attention to everything I say because she catches all these little things that I just get confused and miss. So it's okay. So I appreciate it, actually. So the beginning of the story, is, as I see it, really starts in chapter 4 in verse 24. Which is this very, very odd story about Moses' wife, Zipporah, or Sephora, as it is in the Douay Rheims version, getting upset because of Moses' requirement that the children be circumcised. And in this story, there's this angel who is coming to kill the whole family of Moses because Moses has not circumcised his children. And so it's actually Zipporah who circumcises Moses' first child, throws the foreskin at Moses, and said, "You are a husband of blood to me." Now, the reason I think that this is the beginning, the first in the sequence of this part of the story, is because the child obviously is very young. He's got two children. So the child is very young. In the story, as it is in Exodus, occurs while they're on their way back to Egypt, which doesn't make sense chronologically. So this is probably the beginning of the story. And while this doesn't have a whole lot of theological detail, it does tell us a little bit about the character and personality of Moses. Not a real strong-willed man. He goes to Midian, he marries this Midianite woman, he has these children, and he says, "We have to circumcise these kids." And Zipporah says, "You're not coming near my young boy with that knife." And so the child goes uncircumcised for a while. And then there's a story of the angel that's coming to slay them. But Zipporah at this point relents, circumcises him, and they're able to go on. So it's, again, a little bit about the character of Moses. Not real strong will, doesn't enforce his will on his wife. But obviously, she's the one who's kind of directing the family at this point. Now, later, And again, in chapter 4, although we're starting in chapter 3, this earliest sequence occurs in chapter 4. God speaks to Aaron, who is at this time in Egypt, and says, go meet Moses at the mountain of God. And so Aaron packs up and he starts coming towards Moses. And we'll see why this has to occur earlier in the story in order for it to make sense. Now, the mountain of God, if you read through the book of Exodus and all through the Old Testament, actually, there's this tremendous confusion about what is the mountain of God. What's its name? Where is it? Sometimes you hear it referred to as Mount Horeb. Other times you hear it referred to as Mount Sinai. And I spent hours slaving through this, studying, looking at Chaldean roots and Sumerian words and all kinds of possibilities. And then suddenly it occurred to me, if you just put the two, translate the two words directly into Hebrew, Mount Horeb means to burn, to brightness or burning, a bright fire is what it really means. And so a lot of Bible scholars will say it's the mountain of the sun. And Sinai, they say from a Sumerian root, means the mountain of the moon. But it doesn't mean any of that stuff. Horeb means to burn, and in Hebrew, Sinai, means bush. It's the mountain of the burning bush. It was so simple when I realized it. Horeb, Sinai means the burning bush. It is the mountain of the burning bush. Where it's located, there's just a gazillion different places. There's a traditional Mount Sinai on the peninsula of Sinai, on the Sinai Peninsula. But there are an awful lot of archaeologists who say, no, it's in Arabia. Other archaeologists say, no, it's in Jordan, up near what is it? Petra, which was the city of Petra. We don't know for certain. I favor the Petra location, personally. If you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have probably said I like the Arabian version. But we really don't know where this mountain is. But this is the mountain of God, which is the mountain of the burning bush. Now, Moses is a shepherd in the tribe of Midian, land of Midian. Now, the land of Midian, it's not a land. The Midianites were a nomadic people. It's a tribe of people. They wandered all over, which is another reason why I have a hard time finding this mountain, because the Midianites were everywhere. They were nomadic people, and everywhere from Arabia to Sinai up into Jordan, the Midianites were there as they followed their flocks and moved in grazing land, much like our own Plains Indians. And our Plains Indians would follow the buffalo, but the Midianites, they followed grazing land. They'd graze for a while here, eat up the grass. There's not a lot of grass in the desert. They moved to the next spot, moved to the next spring, moved to the next spring, as then they all rotated around looking for water, looking for grazing land. The Midianites were descendants of Abraham by his second wife, Keturah. So these were kinsmen of Moses, also descendants of Abraham. So he is a shepherd, and he is watching his sheep, doing his thing, and he sees a bush. And it is a fire. It's on fire, but the bush is not burning. And it was a very, very bright fire, which is what the word Horeb means. And he is struck by this. He is stirred. So he goes to see what is about to take place. So he takes time away from his sheep and goats and goes to see this strange event, this thing, this bush that is burning, but it is not consumed. And as God speaks to Moses, first thing he tells him to do is take off his shoes, for the ground on which you're standing is holy ground. It's a very, very fascinating phraseology. Basically, God is saying, this is holy dirt. Now, what makes dirt holy? What makes that little plot of ground more holy than any other piece of ground? And it's not that the dirt is any different. It's that the presence of God is there in a very, very unique and special way. And it is so holy that Moses has to remove anything that separates him from the holiness, the touch, the feel of this earth that God's presence is at. And we can imagine Moses' reaction to this. Now, like we said, we just mentioned this story with Zipporah and the circumcision. And Moses is not a real strong personality. I mean, look back at his life. He runs away from Pharaoh. He's henpecked by his wife. He lacks self-confidence. When God gives him a directive, first thing Moses says is, "I can't do it. I can't do it. The Egyptians hate me. I cannot do it. My people don't like me. I cannot do it." He's embarrassed by his stuttering, and he very clearly tells God that he has gotten the wrong man. In fact, the only qualification that Moses seems to have is that he was not too busy to take time to seek God. That he is able to leave his sheep and goats behind and take time to set aside and go to seek God. Find God in this place. And he's very confused. He's not a great theologian. He looks at this bush and he hears the voice, and the first thing Moses asks is, "All right, so what's your name?" Now, if you see the Cecil B. DeMille movie, which is about as far from the truth of the story as the latest Noah film is, the Hebrews are running around saying, worshiping the God without a name. He kind of pretends that nobody knows the name of God, which, of course, is not true. They'd understood the name of God for a long time. But mostly God was worshipped under the name of El at this point in patriarchal history. But Moses was raised in Pharaoh's court. He was familiar with hundreds of gods. He knew lots of gods. And basically what he's asking when he says, "What's your name?" he's saying, "Which God are you? Which God is actually taking time to talk to me, to speak to him?" And then God speaks his name. And it is one of the most profound statements of the nature and character of God in the entire Bible. God says to Moses, his name is I Am. I Am. It's that simple. I Am. Because when he does that, he is telling Moses he is not one God among many. He is not even one being among many. He is not the highest being or the most supreme being. He is not a being at all. He is all being. St. Paul puts it this way: God is all and is in all. We grow very confused about this because we're always trying to anthropomorphize God. We're always trying to bring God somehow into a box where we can quantify him and say, "Okay, here is God, I can understand what I'm dealing with." But God is saying he is so far beyond that. He is not a supreme being. He is not one God like Zeus or a God like Horus, an Egyptian god, or even God like Ra, the supreme sun god. He is all and in all. St. Thomas Aquinas, reflecting on this passage, says, "God declares that he is the true act of to be. That he is being itself. So all things, God is all things, and God is in all things. It actually is a very incarnational way to see the nature of God. Because what God teaches us in the incarnation is that God is not separated from his creation. God is all, and at the same time, God is a little baby. And even now, God is a piece of bread, possessing the complete body, blood, soul, and divinity of God. So when we see God this way, it completely radicalizes our relationship with him. Because God is not out there somewhere in heaven watching over us. God inhabits every atom of our being. Everything that makes us up is all an expression of the presence of God. So God tells Moses to take off his shoes because it's holy ground. Because God's presence is there. But God's presence rests in each one of us. And we need to see ourselves as holy, as called, as set aside, as being used by God. We sing the song, it's holy ground, but then the next verse is, these are holy hands. Because you use these hands, and so they are holy. And I think one of the reasons we see this terrible rise in atheism in our day is because we have tried to confine God in a box, which kind of worked for a while. But with advancements in science and space exploration, and our understanding of the universe has gotten so big that the little understanding we taught our kids about God in Sunday school, suddenly the universe is bigger than God. And so God goes by the wayside. We need to gather an understanding that the entire universe is just an expression of the presence of God. Just touching on quantum field theory for just a second. I always get in trouble when I do this. When we were in school, we were taught the world is made up of atoms, and atoms are made of protons, electrons, and neutrons, right? We all learned that in school. They don't think that anymore. There's no such thing as an electron. An electron is just a manifestation within an electron field. The entire universe is one electron field, one field. And each individual electron is just a manifestation within that field. If we see God in a similar way, we're able to touch things. They have solidity to us. But in reality, they're just manifestations of energy in fields that are throughout the universe. God's the same way. We're able to experience God. But our experience of God is just a manifestation of being. When God is all being throughout the entire universe, it's like there is an incarnation in a moment that we experience. But the whole of God is at all places, at all times. And I like what CJ once said to me. He says, I'm swimming in God. And that's what we're doing. Our lives, we are swimming in God. I wanted to talk a little bit about the that particular part of the divine name. And I think I'm pretty much going to end there. And I'll pick up the rest tomorrow as we prepare to go into, or tomorrow, next week when we prepare to go to Egypt. We'll talk about the plagues. But I just want to say a couple of things. One is that Aaron comes to Moses while he's on the mountain. Because Moses complains, I can't do it. He says, Aaron will help you. And suddenly Aaron shows up. Because remember, Aaron had been told, you know, to go to the Mount of God. Find Moses. So he walks in. I love these kind of timing things. We see these timing things in our lives all the time, don't we? And one other thing on the name of God. We call God God, which is not God's name. God actually comes from the German Gott, which means God, T-O-T-T, God, which actually literally means the one you pray to. The one you pray to, that's God. That's what God means. And it's a decent name for, you know, it's a decent understanding of God. But we can pray to all kinds of things and all kinds of people. But there is one that whoever we pray to is all and in all. And so all of life becomes a prayer as we are swimming in the presence of God. Our thoughts, our conversations, and the times we set aside for worship. All of life is a prayer as we swim in the presence of God. And speaking of prayer, let's go to God now in prayer.